This is
KUT.
KUT, Austin.
Stop.
This is KUT Weekend for the fourth weekend of February 2020. Thank you for joining us. I'm Jerry Quijano with KUT 90.5, the NPR station in Austin, Texas. Here's what we've got for you this week. We find out who's behind the funny little messages on signs along Austin roads.
Around the holidays, there's always like some sort of pun that they do. Like it's always like, no offense to the guy, but they're really lame, like sort of dad puns.
Austin landlords repeatedly cited for health and safety violations could get their right to rent revoked.
Kitchen full of filthy dishes. I can't take a proper shower.
And after a rise in mothers dying in childbirth, the state of Texas came up with a plan. We find out how it's going.
Not only have you reduced the total cost of care, but you've improved their morbidity and mortality.
Those stories and more in this edition of KUT Weekend. We kick off this week's episode with two big departures in the Austin area. On Tuesday, former Austin mayor and current state senator Kirk Watson announced he's leaving the legislature in April. As KUT's Jimmy Moss reports, one of the state's most influential Democrats is moving into academia.
After serving the city of Austin for more than two decades, first as mayor, then as state senator, Kirk Watson is moving to Houston. He will serve as dean for University of Houston's new Hobby School of Public Affairs. Watson says he'll miss the people of Austin.
They have trusted me. They have voted for me. They have invited me into their lives. And we've worked very closely together on a variety of different programs and projects that have literally been transformative and I think will make a difference in this community for generations.
As mayor, Watson's growth initiatives altered the course and the skyline of Austin as a burgeoning tech hub. As a legislator, he led the charge for the Dell Medical School and a number of transportation initiatives to improve Austin's freeways. Watson's resignation takes effect at the end of April. Jimmy Moss, KUT News.
And the following day, AISD Superintendent Paul Cruz announced he's resigning from the district to work at the University of Texas. Now, as KUT's Claire McInerney reports, the future of a major initiative Cruz started, a process of closing schools, is unknown.
Last spring, Cruz said the district must close schools to help the district's financial problems. Originally, his team put forward a list of 12 schools. Then the school board voted in November to close four of those schools and said they would come back to the other eight. The board or school district has not publicly said whether they will go forward with closing those other eight schools. Cruz said he doesn't know when he'll be able to make that announcement.
That's a conversation as far as specific date I will be having with the board, because there are so many moving parts and there is so much significant work ahead.
The school board meets Monday to discuss how to proceed with Cruz's resignation and finding a replacement. Claire McInerney, KUT News.
And researchers at the University of Texas and the National Institutes of Health have created a 3D atomic map of part of the novel coronavirus. KUT Sangeeta Menon reports that's an early step toward the development of a vaccine.
Researchers have created an atomic map for the spike protein part of the virus. That's the part that attaches to and infects human cells. Jason McLeland is the associate professor at UT who led the research.
And with this map, we and other researchers can then begin to perform rational engineering approaches to try and design small molecules, antibodies, and vaccine antigens against the coronavirus.
McLeland says that sharing their map with researchers around the world is an important step toward vaccine development, but he warns it's still a long process and optimistically, the first vaccines will still take 18 to 24 months to develop. Sangeeta Menon, KUT News.
More than a year ago, Texas health officials launched a program aimed at getting hospitals to curb their rates of maternal deaths and complications during labor. KUT's Ashley Lopez checked in on how hospitals in the state are adjusting to these new protocols.
This is the nurse's station on the labor and delivery floor of Ascension Seton Medical Center in Austin. At the station, there's a wall of computer screens, which is surrounded by mounds of paperwork. And then there's this big filing cabinet on wheels. The cabinet was created to basically eliminate any chaos during a delivery. Rochelle Labonte, a nurse, shows me what's inside.
There's a scale in there to measure blood loss. And then we have a refrigerator that's built in that contains hemorrhage medications that we need to give in an emergency situation. So everything is right at their hands in an emergency.
Seton started using this card after state health officials started this program in the summer of 2018 called Texas AIM. It's a program that hospitals can opt into. The whole point of it is to make hospitals safer for women having babies. Amy Pabst is the chief medical officer at Seton, which delivers about 4,800 babies a year. She says they joined as soon as they could.
We deliver the most babies, and we're the biggest hospital, and we wanted to reduce morbidity and mortality associated with childbirth.
This all started because a few years ago, officials began to hear growing concerns about the rate of women dying or almost dying while giving birth in Texas. Manda Hall with the Texas Department of State Health Services says the state needed to do something.
We all kind of have looked at it and understood that there were things that we could get better at as far as improving our maternal health outcomes here in Texas.
Hall says hospitals are just one piece of this larger effort, but it's a big piece. Out of the roughly 225 hospitals in the state with obstetric services, almost all have joined Texas AIM. And so far, doctors say they've seen three big shifts in hospitals. Back at Ascension Seton Medical Center in Austin, Dr. Jenny Gardy, the maternal medical director there, says the first huge shift has been that the program has standardized how doctors screen for hemorrhages and how they treat it to make sure women don't die of blood loss.
Traditionally, physicians have just sort of estimated the blood loss at the time of delivery, and it's usually a visual inspection. It's notoriously inaccurate.
What that means is that until recently, doctors used to just literally look at the amount of blood on a hospital bed and decide whether they think it's a problem. Now, Gardy says, for every vaginal delivery, they take steps to figure out a quantitative blood loss.
What quantitative blood loss is that there's actual measurement in a calibrated drape of blood after a vaginal delivery, and then also any of the sponges that are soaked with blood are weighed.
Basically, there's no more guesswork. Nurses have to stop and actually do the math to figure out how much blood was lost. Staff is also looking out for changes in vital signs, and certain changes automatically trigger a series of steps that's been compared to pilots landing a plane. Amy Pab says this reduces the differences in care from patient to patient.
Reducing the variability, much like your pilot analogy, leads to better outcomes. And we have a ton of data that proves that.
And that brings me to the second shift in hospitals since Texas AIM. Manda Hall with the Texas Department of State Health Services says this program has opened the lines of communication between hospitals across the state.
Hospitals are coming together and they can talk about their challenges. They can also talk about areas where they've excelled in, and they can kind of share that. They can share policies, they can share procedures, they can share tools.
And this has actually been super helpful for smaller rural hospitals. Leslie Barnard is a director of family birthplace at Permian Regional Medical Center in Andrews, which is in far west Texas. Barnard says her hospital only delivers about 330 babies a year. And in the past, when she wanted to improve care, she mostly could only get in touch with bigger hospitals.
So many times I talk to different directors at a large hospital. I'm like, how do you get this done? Or, you know, how do you do this? And she's like, well, on your team. I'm like, you don't understand. We don't have a team like that here, you know?
But Manda Hall says rural hospitals like Barnard's have been able to figure out how to make all of these ambitious protocols work.
I believe we have around 90% of rural hospitals in our state have enrolled. And they have to be, a little more innovative and kind of thinking through different challenges they may have.
And Leslie Barnard says when a smaller hospital does come up with a creative solution to some of these issues, they share it with all the other small hospitals. She says it's been a game changer.
It's nice to be able to meet with other small hospitals and how they get that to work for them.
And the last shift created by Texas AIM has to do with data. There's now a central location where all hospitals are sending data on health outcomes for women who have babies in their delivery wards. Various researchers and advocates have been raising concerns for years about how unreliable maternal mortality and morbidity data is in Texas. Manda Hall with the Texas Department of State Health Services says hospitals aren't just sending data along, though. She says they're also taking a close look at it themselves.
And so we've also seen an increase in the number of hospitals that are having these multidisciplinary reviews so that they can learn from an event that happened so that we can continue to improve and get better.
All of these changes are more work for hospitals, and in some cases, it's required them to hire more staff and spend money. But Amy Pabst with Ascension Seton Medical Center in Austin says it's been worth it for a lot of reasons.
We're actually saving money. And if you look at it from a total cost of care, if you are identifying a patient who is at risk for a postpartum hemorrhage and you're able to intervene and be more aware of that, and then you don't have to give them a blood transfusion because you were able to do that, not only have you reduced the total cost of care, but you've improved their morbidity and mortality.
Because this is a relatively new program, there still isn't useful data on whether all of this has actually saved women's lives. But doctors and state officials say they're hopeful because at least now hospitals are working together with the express purpose of saving lives. Ashley Lopez, KUT News.
Flaring is the practice of burning off natural gas that comes out of oil wells. Experts estimate in Texas, enough is burned daily to power every home in the state. That volume has sparked outcry from environmentalists and even some in the industry, and that has prompted one state regulator to issue a first-of-its-kind report on flaring. KUT's Mose Bouchel has the details.
The state agency that regulates oil and gas is called the Railroad Commission of Texas. Right now, it's being sued by a pipeline company for how it allows flaring to happen. It's in this context that Railroad Commissioner Ryan Sitton issued his report. It looks at flared gas not just by volume, but in terms of how much associated oil is produced. And the report says that if you look at how much oil Texas produces compared to how much gas we burn off, Texas is doing much better than Iraq and Iran. Critics of flaring were quick to push back. Colin Layden works on regulatory affairs for the Environmental Defense Fund.
I think we need to stop trying to point the finger at Iraq and Iran and Russia. Those are not the sort of countries you'd compare yourself to if you were being serious about trying to fix the problem here.
Meanwhile, some researchers who track flaring using satellite imagery believe the problem in Texas is even worse than Railroad Commission numbers show. Mose Bouchel, KT News.
Low-level drug possession arrests are ineffective and harmful to people who need community-based help rather than jail time is the conclusion of a new report about Travis County. KUT's Dani Matias has more.
The Texas Criminal Justice Coalition, Grassroots Leadership, the Texas Harm Reduction Alliance, and the UT Law Civil Rights Clinic analyzed Travis County data. They found people of color are disproportionately arrested for these kinds of crimes. For instance, black people made up less than 9% of Travis County's population between 2017 and 2018, but accounted for almost 30% of possession arrests made during that time. About 28% of those arrested for low-level drug possession were under the age of 25. The report says for young people of color, an arrest increases the likelihood of future jail time. The report recommends terminating prosecution and incarceration for possession of less than 4 grams of a controlled substance and developing a harm reduction-based strategy to address substance abuse. Dani Matias, KUT News.
If or when the Texas Department of Transportation decides to move Interstate 35 through downtown Austin underground, something will have to be done with the space left behind above ground. And as KUT's Samuel King reports, the nonprofit Urban Land Institute will start to study the issue next week.
Plans for the central part of the I-35 Capital Express project through downtown aren't finished. But the Downtown Austin Alliance says it's still the moment to launch a community conversation. So a team from the Urban Land Institute will come to Austin next week to tour the area and develop initial recommendations. Other cities such as Dallas and Atlanta have undertaken similar projects. DeWitt Peart is the president and CEO of the Downtown Austin Alliance.
If we're looking to shape the way downtown and East Austin functions and how you improve mobility on the surface, now is the time to begin planning for that.
The Urban Land Institute will present its initial findings next Friday at 8 a.m. at Houston Tillotson University, expects to make a final report later this year. TxDOT still needs billions of dollars in funding before construction on the central portion of the Capital Express project can begin. Samuel King, KUT News.
As some of Austin's apartments age, repairs are needed. Fixes to faulty air conditioners, appliances, and even dealing with mold. If a landlord doesn't make these repairs, they could be cited by the city's code department. But as KUT's Audrey McGlinchey explains, Austin's code department has been sitting on something for years, an enforcement tool that could be very persuasive to landlords.
The hot water.
All right, so let me feel it.
I've got a thermometer.
So it's still cold.
Stephen Frischmuth's been without hot water for a week.
Oh, here it is.
Still cold. This is some real investigative work, people. Okay, we're sticking a thermometer in the water.
Frischmuth lives in an apartment complex in North Austin. There, he says, he's often fighting for basic amenities.
It says about 70, but this does not feel like 70 to me.
As you might imagine, living without hot water makes everyday tasks hard.
Kitchen full of filthy dishes. I can't take a proper shower.
When a tenant has a problem, they can call 311 and it'll go to the city's code department. An inspector will come out and may issue a violation. If the landlord doesn't make the fixes, it could escalate to a fine. Currently, Frischmuth's landlord owes a little over $6,000 to the city. But even with these fines, there's still no hot water. So tenants like Frischmuth and housing advocates say the city should take bolder action. But before we get to that, let's back up a bit.
Four people were forced to pack up and move out after their South Austin apartments are deemed just too dangerous. Good afternoon. I'm Leslie Rohde.
I'm Robert Hadlock.
In 2012, at least two dozen families were evacuated from their apartment building on East Riverside after a balcony collapsed. When city inspectors showed up, they found lots of other code violations.
It's a mass exodus at the Woodridge apartment complex after dozens more residents were kicked out on Monday.
As KXAN reported at the time, some kids even had to miss school.
They had 20 minutes to move out.
After code compliance officers inspected the apartments, even more buildings were deemed unsafe to live in.
That really was a wake-up call to the community that we needed to put a better focus on our rental properties.
Daniel Word is with the city's code department. Even with something as dramatic as a balcony collapse, it took council members a year to pass something. In 2013, they voted to create a program that would keep an eye on problem properties, called the Repeat Offender Program. Basically, if a landlord's been cited for health and safety issues several times in a two-year period,
broken windows, to something as, you know, a loose handrail, or a loose step on a set of stairs,
they have to pay a fee, and the property goes on a public list. The property's then subject to periodic inspections. When the city created the program, they gave themselves this power. If a landlord isn't making repairs, they can no longer rent to new tenants. It's a muscle the city's waited more than 6 years to flex.
Why did it take the city so long to give itself the ability to do that?
Correct. So, again, the ordinance was implemented in 2013, but it was a brand new ordinance and it was a brand new program. So it took some time to get the ordinance up and running, get the staffing in place to handle the ordinance.
But Frischmuth, who, by the way, got his hot water back, and his neighbors say the 6 years that passed was time they sometimes spent without basic amenities. Take Jose Perez, his wife Mariana, and their two kids. They were afraid of their stove. Yep, you heard that right.
Pues le tenemos miedo a la estufa.
Perez said as much to a city commission this past August. He described, through a translator, how he thought the appliance in his apartment's kitchen had faulty wiring, how when he tried to use it, sometimes it would catch fire. One time, his family even used soda to put out the flames.
Ya una vez, la tuvimos que apagar con Coca-Cola.
One of the managers of the building was sitting at this city commission. The next day, Perez says he got a new stove. But this was after 3 years, Perez told me, and having asked nearly 20 times for the stove to be fixed. So when he hears that the code department says it takes time to start enforcing something, something he and others say they think will force landlords to make repairs faster, Perez extends an invitation.
Yo los invitaría a ellos personalmente.
He's saying he personally invites code employees.
Que si ellos pudieran pasar una noche o un fin de semana en un apartamento sin servicios.
To stay a night or a weekend in an apartment without services like his family has.
Como nosotros lo pasamos, entenderían y tomarían acciones.
Then they would understand and take action, he says. Perez and Frischmuth hope their landlord will be the first sanctioned by the city. The company that owns the property did not respond to a request for comment. As for the code department, it says this month it'll begin considering which properties they may start penalizing. Audrey McGlinchey, KUT News.
Early voting is officially underway for the 2020 Texas primaries, but most Texans under 40 say they did not hear from any political campaign. That's according to a new poll from researchers at Tufts University. KUT's Ashley Lopez reports Latino voters under 40 are the least likely to have heard from a campaign.
66% of all Texas voters under 40 said they had not been contacted by any political campaign or party by January. About 75% of Latinos under 40 said that they had not heard from a campaign yet either. That's compared to 60% of white Texans under 40. Charlie Bonner is with Move Texas, a group trying to get young people more civically engaged. He says this has been a missed opportunity for campaigns.
So not only is this not making an investment in the future of our democracy and the future of our elections, this is a really poor way to win an election. You cannot win without young people in this state.
During the last election, turnout among Texas voters under 30 tripled compared to the previous midterm election, contributing to one of the closest statewide elections in decades. Researchers found that 39% of voters under 40 say they are extremely likely to participate in this year's primary. Ashley Lopez, KUT News.
Some Capital Metro bus drivers staged a symbolic protest on their routes Wednesday. The move comes after Cap Metro consolidated its bus operations and maintenance services from two companies to one. The protest is called the Black Eye Campaign. Some drivers wore black makeup or black stickers under their eye to protest what they feel is unfair treatment by Cap Metro and MV Transportation. Back in August, Cap Metro agreed to a $1.4 billion contract with the transportation company to handle all of its bus operations. But MV Transportation hasn't yet reached an agreement with the transit union that represents the drivers. Brent Payne is the president of Amalgamated Transit Union Local 1091. He says the duration of the negotiations is causing a safety issue for some employees.
We have a lot of operators working 14, 16, and 18 hours a day. We have maintenance mechanics that are working, 12-hour days, 14-hour days.
MV Transportation and the union continued negotiations on Thursday and Friday, but Payne didn't anticipate those talks to end favorably. He's asking his members to attend next week's Cap Metro board meeting to voice their concerns. Traffic. It is one of the constants of life in Austin, but every so often there's something that breaks the monotony of brake lights. A sign in the distance that reads, "Baby Yoda uses a car seat. Be safe, he will." Someone asked our AT Explained project just who is behind the sometimes clever light-up road signs that remind you to be safe on the road. KUT's Samuel King has the story.
Like many Austinites, UT student Evan Hearn spends a lot of time on the road.
I live up north, right? And so I'm a student and I have a couple jobs. So I'm constantly either in the car or on the bus, you know, going one way or another.
All that time on the road, stuck in traffic, can make Hearn and other drivers go mad.
You know, you hate everything about your life in that moment. You hate everybody around you.
But then it appears like a beacon of calm, a sign reminding you that you're not a candle, so don't drive lit. Or designate a driver, bevo the game.
Around the holidays, there's always like some sort of pun that they do. Like it's always like, no offense to the guy, but they're really lame, like sort of dad puns that they do about like Easter or like Christmas or the 4th of July or whatever.
Evan wondered who is behind the messages on the electronic signs along Austin's roads. Who is this mythical, omniscient person or dad algorithm who spits out bad jokes and good advice?
If the sign is telling me, like if the sign is calling me out, on my bad driving, I should probably calm down. I'm going to get home eventually, so.
Well, who that person is, and it is a person, not a robot, yet, depends on the road. The big highways, it's someone from TxDOT. On the toll roads, it could be someone from the Central Texas Regional Mobility Authority. On city streets like Lamar and Cesar Chavez, it's a team from the city of Austin. Engineer Joshua Bapuria is on that team. He isn't a dad, but he takes pride in his dad jokes.
I enjoy it, but my coworkers sometimes they get a little bit tired of it, so they just retreat to their corner.
Oh, so you make dad jokes in person, too.
I do. Only the best reach the signs, I would say. Or worst, it depends how you define it.
Thankfully, he doesn't always have the final say. It's a group effort. There's a whole team whose job it is to come up with these signs.
We would come up with something like simple that everybody understands, like a Drake reference or Matthew McConaughey reference. And from there, we would just come up with a rhyme or something simple that we could be like, oh, this is a quick, you know, 15 words that people would laugh at, but then it would also stick the memory in their head.
It's harder than it sounds. In 2017, the city asked people to come up with their own signs, and while 15 submissions made the cut, hundreds more were rejected, including one saying, cars don't cuddle, leave some room, and everyone yearns for signaled turns. Joshua's boss, Jen Duffy, says it's not always fun and games. Duffy says even the signs with jokes actually serve a serious purpose. They remind people the signs are there. And they often display serious messages, like the recent signs aimed at reducing traffic fatalities.
So we do get questions sometimes, you know, why are we putting these somewhat silly messages up there? But they always have a key point that we're trying to get across.
Even if you haven't eaten at El Arroyo on West 5th, you probably know their other claim to fame, funny signs. And they apparently felt Bapuria and the other road sign artists were edging in on their turf. El Arroyo made one of their signs that said, "Who's the intern trying to steal our marquee thunder?"
And I was just like minorly offended because on the one hand, I was like, we're not a textile intern. I work with signals. I'm an engineer. On the other hand, I was like, hey, I got featured on the El Arroyo marquee a little bit. So I'll take that as a win.
If the jokes get you to notice the signs, then maybe you'll get the message they're trying to get across. After learning the method behind the madness, Evan Hearn sure thinks so.
We can agree that objectively people who block the box are the worst kind of people. So maybe by seeing the sign, they will sort of rethink what they're doing. And so that's like an actual like impactful in the real world sort of situation.
Samuel King, KUT News.
And that's KUT Weekend for the fourth weekend of February 2020. You can subscribe to this podcast at weekend.kut.org, and you can email any questions or comments to weekend@kut.org, or you can just ask me on Twitter. I'm at Jerry Quijano. Our theme music is by RAC. Thank you for joining us. I'm Jerry Quijano with KUT 90.5 and KUT.org. Thank you.